You know how it is, you're keen to really understand something, get beyond just the headlines, but finding the time, well, it's tricky. So that's what we're doing here today. A proper deep dive into a really quite remarkable landmark in Dundalk, Ireland, St. Patrick's Church.
Yeah, and for this dive, we've pulled together quite a bit of material, historical accounts that trace its story, architectural details, the real nuts and bolts and timelines to help piece it all together.
Exactly. And our mission, if you like, is to uncover the story behind St. Patrick's. We want to understand what makes it so significant architecturally and historically.
And hopefully give you a real appreciation for it.
Okay, so let's start with something maybe a bit surprising. The huge St. Patrick's Church you see in Dundalk today, it actually wasn't the first one.
That's right. Our sources show there was an earlier church, also dedicated to St. Patrick, set up way back in 1750.
1750. That's going back quite a way.
It really is.
Yep.
And this original church was on Chapel Street.
Right, but the story of how they got the land, that's where it gets kind of interesting, isn't it?
It does. Apparently, it was a donation from the first Earl of Clanbrassil.
Okay, a donation, but why?
Well, the story goes that a British army officer around 1748 saw local Catholics attending Mass near St. Helena's Quay in, let's see, very basic conditions. And this officer was apparently quite moved by their devotion, so much so that he actually persuaded the Earl to grant them the land for a proper church building.
Wow. Okay, let's just pause on that. This is happening during the penal
Oh,
laws.
exactly. A time with serious restrictions on Catholic worship.
So, having a British army officer pushing for a Catholic church build, that's really quite unusual for the period.
It really is. It sort of hints at the complexities, maybe the local dynamics, that could exist even under those strict laws. Individual actions making a difference.
Yeah, fascinating. So, this first St. Patrick's, it served the community for almost 100 years.
Pretty much a century, yeah. Then its role changed. In 1843, it became a school. And then later, 1867, the Irish Christian Brothers took it over. So that original building had its own long history.
But clearly, by the early 1800s, something needed to change. A bigger church, perhaps?
Seems likely. The Catholic population was probably growing, especially as the penal laws eased off. So in 1834, they acquired the site where the current St. Patrick's stands.
And there was a key figure driving this.
Yes, the parish priest at the time, Father Matthew McCann, he seems to have been the real champion for this new, much grander church.
He really pushed for it.
He did, and he brought in a very well-regarded architect, Thomas Duff of Newry.
Thomas Duff. Now, I think one source mentions a John Duff.
Yeah, there's a passing mention, but all the main evidence points strongly to Thomas Duff. He was a big name in church architecture in the Northeast back then.
Okay, that's important. Thomas Duff, renowned architect. We're talking major projects like Armagh Cathedral, Newry Cathedral.
Exactly. He was the go-to guy.
So Father McCann gets Duff involved, the foundations are laid. But sadly, Father McCann didn't see it finished.
Now, unfortunately, he passed away in 1837, just as things were getting started.
But the project carried on.
It did.
Yeah.
And the new St. Patrick's finally opened for worship on January 1st, 1842.
1842. And there was someone quite famous at the opening mass, wasn't there?
Yes. Daniel O'Connell himself was there.
Wow, O'Connell, that really signals how important this new church was, doesn't it? A symbol of, growing Catholic confidence and emancipation.
Absolutely. You can imagine the significance for the Dundalk community. This grand new building, O'Connell present, was a major statement.
Definitely. So, new site, Father McCann's vision, Thomas Duff's expertise. Let's dig into the design itself. What was Duff aiming for?
Well, Duff had a lot of experience, obviously. And for St. Patrick's, he looked towards some very famous English examples for inspiration.
Okay, like what?
For the exterior, the model seems to have been King's College Chapel in Cambridge.
Ah, right. Famous for that perpendicular Gothic style. Very tall windows, lots of vertical lines, that sense of height and light.
Precisely. That's the look. You can definitely see echoes of that in St. Patrick's exterior. And then for the inside.
He looked somewhere else.
Yes, he drew inspiration from Exeter Cathedral, which is known for its English monastic style.
And the key feature there is the roof, that ribbed vaulting.
Exactly. That complex web of stone ribs creating the vault. It looks amazing, but it's structural too. Gives that feeling of immense space inside.
It's interesting, isn't it, how often Irish churches from this time looked to English models?
It really is. Was it just the architectural fashion of the day? Or maybe something deeper about cultural connections? It's definitely food for thought.
But as you said, Duff didn't get to finish the interior himself. He passed away in 1848.
That's right. So the project needed someone else to see it through. And they brought in another giant of Irish architecture, James Joseph McCarthy.
J.J. McCarthy, a huge name in the Gothic Revival movement based in Dublin.
The very same. So it became almost a collaboration across time, in a way.
So McCarthy picked up where Duff left off. What were his main contributions inside?
His specific work included designing the high altar and also those really ornate screens you see on the east wall. He brought his own interpretation of the Gothic Revival style to complete the vision.
So it's not just one architect's work, but a blend, a kind of dialogue between Duff and McCarthy.
Exactly. And that layering, I think, gives the church part of its unique character. It wasn't just one single plan executed start to finish.
Right. So the church opens in 1842. McCarthy comes in later to finish the interior. But the building story wasn't over even then, was it? There were interruptions.
No, not by a long shot. There was a massive interruption, actually. The Great Famine hit in the mid-1840s.
Of course. Devastating.
Absolutely devastating. And understandably, building projects like the church just had to stop. All focus, all resources had to go towards dealing with the famine and the suffering.
It's a stark reminder of the context, isn't it? Building this grand church while the community was going through such hardship.
It really is. It makes the fact that they eventually resumed work around 1860 even more remarkable. It speaks volumes about their resilience.
It certainly does. And then much later came one of the most prominent features, that big bell tower, the campanile.
Yes, that was added in 1903. And it has quite a personal story behind it, too.
Oh.
It was actually a donation from a Mrs. Julia Hamill in memory of her husband, John Hamill of Seatown.
Oh, that's lovely. A personal memorial becoming part of this public landmark. Ties it back to the local families.
Mm-hmm. And the architects for the tower were a firm called Messrs. Ashlin and Coleman.
And built by locals, too.
Yes. A Dundalk firm, James Wynn & Co., did the construction. So very much a local effort in that phase.
And there were other additions over the years as well, enhancing the inside.
Yes, definitely. Those really striking mosaic walls in the sanctuary area.
Yeah.
They were started in 1909 by a company from Manchester, Ludwig Oppenheimer & Co.
They add so much color and richness.
They really do. And even earlier, back in 1850, a screen was put up at the front of the church, work done by a Belfast firm, Robinson and Kelly.
And the organ. Can't forget the organ.
Right. Installed in 1900 and then officially opened or dedicated in 1901, Cardinal Logue himself presided over that ceremony.
So it really paints a picture of continuous development, doesn't it? A living building evolving over decades, shaped by different people and events.
Absolutely. It wasn't just built and finished. It grew, it changed, it overcame challenges. That long history is part of what makes it so special.
Okay, so speaking of today, let's imagine stepping inside St. Patrick's now. What strikes you?
Well, the first thing is probably the scale. It's big, 9 bays long, with aisles running down both the north and south sides.
And you mentioned those granite pillars earlier, probably from Newry linking back to Duff.
That's the thinking, yeah. They give it this real sense of solidity, of grandeur. And you've got the tiled floors and, of course, that amazing vaulted ceiling we talked about. Classic Gothic Revival.
And the light must be incredible with the stained glass windows.
Oh, definitely. Beautiful, colorful windows. Some by Franz Mayer & Co. from Munich. Others by W. Early & Son from Dublin.
And they often depict Irish saints.
Many of them do, yeah.
Yeah.
Creating that connection to local faith and history.
Then there's the high altar, McCarthy's design.
Right, made of cane stone. With those detailed nativity scenes, it really draws your eye. And flanking it, you have side altars with sculptures by Sir Thomas Farrell, The Agony and the Dead Christ. Very powerful pieces.
And the chancel area itself, with those mosaics you mentioned, designed by George Ashlin.
Yes, those elaborate Italian mosaics.
Yeah.
Just another layer of artistry in there. It really is a feast for the eyes.
It sounds incredibly rich and detailed. Do we know the actual dimensions?
Roughly, yeah. About 144 feet long. And maybe 72 feet wide, so a pretty substantial space inside, about 44 by 22 meters.
And the building continued to evolve even into the 20th century.
It did. In 1914, they added that formal terraced approach outside, giving it a grander entrance. And then in 1937, the sacristy, meeting rooms, storage practical additions, but designed carefully by W.H. Byrne & Son and built again by James Wynn & Co. to fit with the original style.
Maintaining that consistency, it really shows how it's this blend, isn't it? Different architects, different artists, different eras, all contributing to the final building.
Absolutely. It's a composite masterpiece, really.
Now, there's another layer to its history. It's Time as a Pro-Cathedral. That's quite a specific title.
It is. It's not something you come across every day.
Yeah.
Essentially, a pro-cathedral acts as a temporary or sometimes a co-cathedral for a diocese.
So St. Patrick's in Dundalk held this special status within the Archdiocese of Armagh.
Yes, for a significant period.
Mm-hmm.
And a really major event cemented that status in 1867.
Which was?
The actual consecration of Michael Caron as the Archbishop of Armagh took place inside St. Patrick's Church.
Wow. Not in Armagh itself, but in Dundalk. That's huge.
It really is. And following that, from 1867 to 1869, St. Patrick's actually served as Archbishop Caron's mensal parish, basically his official home parish while he was Archbishop.
So it had this really elevated status for a time.
Definitely. And there's a connection to the actual St. Patrick's Cathedral in Armagh, too. Well, Archbishop Caron's successor, Daniel McGettigan, was the one who finally saw the Armagh Cathedral project through to completion. And remember who the key architects were for both Armagh and Dundalk.
Duff and McCarthy.
Exactly. So you see this architectural lineage, this connection between the two major churches, reinforced by the historical role Dundalk played as a pro-cathedral.
It really underlines that St. Patrick's Dundalk wasn't just any parish church. It had this unique, significant role in the wider church structure in Ireland for a while.
Precisely. It was a key player, you could say, within the archdiocese during that era.
And beyond the church building itself, it's clearly remained a focal point for the Dundalk community, hasn't it? There are associated buildings, community functions.
Oh, absolutely. There's a religious goods shop attached, which is quite common. But more significantly, there's St. Patrick's Cemetery out in Dowdall's Hill.
Right. Opened back in 1895.
Yes. Serving the community for generations. It's managed by Louth County Council now, and they've done something fantastic. They've put the burial database online.
That's an incredible resource for people tracing family history.
It really is. A direct link back through the generations connected to the church.
Yeah.
And the parish itself today, the parish of St. Patrick Dundalk, actually includes other churches too.
Like St. Nicholas's and Holy Redeemer.
And Holy Family Church, according to their website.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the oratory in Carroll Village.
Mm-hmm.
So St. Patrick's is kind of the historic heart of a wider network.
It really shows its enduring role, doesn't it? Central to the religious life, the social history, the very fabric of Dundalk for such a long time.
Without a doubt.
So wrapping up this deep dive then, it feels like we've really traced the journey of St. Patrick's in Dundalk. Architecturally, it's this amazing Gothic revival piece, shaped by Duff, completed by McCarthy, topped off with that great tower.
Mm-hmm. And historically, its story is woven through so much, from those surprising penal law origins of the first church, through the tragedy of the famine, its time as a pro-cathedral.
Right up to the present day, with all the additions and embellishments. It's clear the stunning church we see now wasn't built overnight. It evolved.
It really did. Built on earlier foundations, quite literally, and shaped by the dedication, the generosity, and the resilience of so many people over so many years.
It makes you think, doesn't it? When you consider all those layers, the architecture, the history, the personal stories held within those walls, what else could they tell us if they could talk? And maybe more importantly, how does really understanding that past change how we see and appreciate the church right now in the present?
That's a great question to leave things on.
Mm.
Definitely something to ponder.